I will give your listeners one great tip, and it can feel awkward to do, but it keeps momentum in the process. And it's an acronym that is HAMBAM. And HAMBAM stands for Have a Meeting, Book a Meeting. So when you're in the sales process and you have interest and the stakeholder on the customer side is seeing value in continuing the process, either getting you to meet some other people or have another meeting with them to understand them in a bit more detail or to do a proposal or pitch to them, before you leave that meeting, book the next meeting.
Ah, that's really cool.
Otherwise, because of people's schedules, you just lose days and weeks and sometimes months, you know, and so now you've lost momentum in that opportunity. And sometimes it's just the loss of momentum that kills the deal.
Bonanza Growth Podcast, innovation, strategy, and UX for SaaS. Bonanza Studios is a growth consultancy for SaaS and fintech startups. Every SaaS business needs to fight in three different battles. First, product market fit, discovering a growing marketing and designing a compelling and undeniable solution to meet that demand. Second, product-led growth, turning your product into a growth vehicle by leveraging outcome-driven UX design. And third, creative marketing and organic brand building. If you're looking for a reliable partner to drive growth, check out our website at bonanza-studios.com.
Yes, it's happening, Steve. How's it going? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling excellent. I'm very often excellent. So great to see you.
So if I don't mind, I see two bikes in the background. What's your relationship with biking?
Well, one mainly full of pain. That's the reality. I do triathlons. So I swim, bike, run, and the bikes are here because A, it's a convenient place to store them, and B, now that the weather has turned a little more hostile, I can jump on at least one of those bikes back there and do my training indoors.
So is this something that you do, basically triathlon is your pursuit?
Yeah, from a fitness, you know, both physical and mentally, it's good for me. So I used to do team sports. So I used to be a footballer, and then I got a little old for football, and then I did a bit of running, and then I injured myself. So I thought, well, maybe I'll jump on a bike, and then if I add the swim, and I can get back to running, then I've got triathlon.
If you can manage the suffering of going through a triathlon, you can definitely kill a sales call.
Well, look, I think that's a really good point. You know, actually, the things that we go and achieve in our personal life can help us in our business life as well.
100%. It's so connected.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about triathlon is that you can't just turn up and hope you're going to get round. Right?
Mm.
You have to put the training in. You've got to have the discipline to spend time across all three, swim, bike, run.
Yeah. Yeah, that's commitment for sure.
Yeah. And particularly the swim, right? I wasn't a great swimmer. And then all of a sudden you're thrown into, or well, you're not thrown in, you step into, you know, a river or the sea or a lake. And not only do you have to deal with swimming, you've got to deal with swimming in amongst hundreds of other people.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And at times it's like being inside a washing machine.
Steve, how important for sales folks to have a strong mindset?
Yeah, I think it's really important. If you want to be successful, then it starts with the mindset, because sales quite often is a self-starting role.
Uh-huh.
Right. If you're waiting for someone else to tell you what to do, how to do it, and when to do it, then you're probably not in the right function.
That's right.
And, you know, uniquely in sales, I think, we have to get used to hearing customers say no. mm-hmm. and rejecting us, you know, sometimes on a daily basis. So not only do you need the mindset of discipline, but you also need to have a resilient mindset to be able to overcome that rejection and find those that say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Or turn the no to the yes.
Yeah. I mean, where that's possible, then, you know, even better. It's maybe not hearing no the first time and really understanding where that no comes from in a conversation to see if there's another way that you can help that customer to make a, well, let's call it a better decision.
Yeah. So the reason that I was instantly wanting to talk to you is because the extensive years that you have coaching folks to run their businesses, to do sales. So it's basically a crash course for me, first and foremost, right? So I would love to tap into your experiences, but maybe for the audience that they haven't looked at you, they don't know anything about you and they haven't looked at your LinkedIn, maybe give us an elevator pitch of who Steve Buss is and what you have been up to.
Sure. So I'm the founding partner of a company called SalesStrong, and we're a sales training, coaching, consulting business. And I started that business 10 years ago, although I've run my own business since 2009. And really, we work with companies in the B2B space across all different industries. So from pharmaceuticals to software to hardware to manufacturing to financial services, really anyone who has a need to improve the capability of their sales team and to grow their business. You know, all businesses come to a point where they need to grow. And, you know, prior to that, I had 10 years in the car industry. I was primarily in marketing and sales jobs. And I've probably done every job in sales from cold calling through to being a sales director. So I have some experience and I still sell. You know, I still, probably similar to you, I still have to sell my own business to others. So it keeps me fresh.
Yeah, I mean, you got to practice what you preach. I mean, I'm not designing anymore, but, you know, sometimes I just, you know, log in with my design folks and like, what are you guys doing? I want to mess around with your designs. They don't like it, but I'm paying. So.
Yes. The right to interfere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really like your extensive, like your background. I think that's something that I would like to get out of this conversation is to basically go back to sales 101. What is sales and how is, like, basically a lot of folks that are listening to this are B2B SaaS CEOs and founders.
Yeah.
Especially in the realm, you know it better than me. We are desperate for sales right now.
Mm.
Right? It's a bad market. It's been a bad market for the past 2 years. And desperate time, desperate measures. I see a lot of desperate actions to get to sales that lead nowhere. What should B2B CEOs, founders do differently, Steve?
Well, I think the first thing is that in a good market, it's easy to sell. You know, you don't have to be particularly skilled when the market is growing, you know, and buyers are more open to seeing the benefit of the service or the product that you're selling. So I think sometimes in a good market, we can get a little lazy.
Yeah.
Because it's easy, right? Maybe it is a bit like turning up for a triathlon. You haven't done any training. You know you can get round, and that's okay, right? There are times when you turn up and you think, I'm really going to suffer unless I've put the effort in. And, you know, the last triathlon I did was an Ironman distance, which is, you know, huge, right? It's 2.4-mile swim. It's 112-mile on the bike, and then it's a marathon at the end, any one of which I think is a challenge. But put all three together, You're soon going to be in a world of pain if you haven't put the effort in. And so I'm going to use that analogy in terms of sales. You know, we've got to get fit for the market because people still win.
Yeah.
People still win the race.
Love it. Right?
Regardless of circumstance. But the people who win the race win it because either they have a product or a service that is so compelling that customers just want it.
Right.
And what a joyful place that is. But that's not the reality for many organizations that have sales teams.
No.
There is some work to be done to understand the customer, understand their needs, and understand, you know, how your product and service is going to help them. So if we've had it easy, it's made us lazy, we've got to get back in the gym, right? We've got to get back in the sales gym. And you've got to start doing all of those good things that we know help from a sales perspective. That means doing some research about different buyer types. Mm. That means doing our outreach, you know, making sure our marketing is working to create as many inbound leads as possible. And there's a proper process to make sure we're lead scoring on inbound activity. It's about finding out whether we've got capacity in our team to do outbound activity. Mm-hmm. Sure that rather than having a rest in between the inbound activity, we're actually doing our research and getting on those phones or reaching out through social media and other forms. Because the thing that kills a business, and you'll know this, is a lack of leads.
Yep.
Right. So fix that first.
Yep.
Yeah. And in a tough market, there's a possibility that the inbound is going to go down.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got to fill the gap with outbound activity. The second thing is, you know, are your sales team fit for purpose from a capability perspective? Right? Can they do good discovery calls? Can they engage the customer? Can they be agile enough to pitch the solution in the context of the customer's situation rather than a more robotic learned pitch?
Right.
So we're looking for more agility and flexibility in our sales team when times are tough. Can they ask for the business?
Yeah.
It might seem really simple, but sometimes people are really awkward about just asking for the business. And one of the reasons for doing that is that I think, from my experience, I observe sales team trying to shortcut the sales process. So it feels they're having to push the close.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that it's almost an arm wrestle with the customer to get some kind of commitment.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a good sales process and you don't shortcut it, if you do it properly and you have that agility and flexibility, the close should be a natural thing.
Right? Yeah.
The customer should be asking you, how do we make this happen?
Mm.
What do I need to do?
Mm.
So it's brushing up on those skills. So that's one part of it. The other bit is, as we mentioned earlier, it's the mindset, right? Again, has our mindset got a little bit lazy? In challenging times, do we withdraw and retreat and blame the market and find 1,000 other excuses for our lack of success? Or do we actually reflect on what we can do and what we can control and influence? You know, and I think that mindset piece is so powerful. And we can do it ourselves, but we can also, you know, if we're leaders of those teams, we can help people think about things in a different way. That it's tough for everyone, but someone's still going to win.
Yeah.
And I always think about, you know, three things to consider if you're the leader of an organization or a leader of a sales team in these organizations. So we've spoken about capability. So is the team capable of doing and winning in this tough market? The second one is culture.
Yeah.
Do we truly have a high performance culture in our organization, or are we just good enough?
Mm.
You know, because high performance is a whole different standard. And in my experience, you know, only somewhere between 5% and 10% of teams I come across, I would say, are truly high performing. You know, there's 100%. Lots of average teams out there, and there's a number of low performing teams. But only 5% to 10% are high performing. And that's because high performance is hard. It's relentless. Right? It's about continual improvement and it's about visible accountability. And people don't always like that. The other side of the equation around high performance is high potential. So if there are only 5 to 10% of organizations are high performance, maybe 70 to 80% have got the potential to be high performing.
That's right.
So how do we translate potential into performance? You know, that there's a great idea I came across by a guy called Timothy Galway, who's sort of a founding father of modern coaching. And he's written some books, a book called The Inner Game of Tennis, The Inner Game of Golf, The Inner Game of Management. It's all about what goes on inside our own mind, but also environmental interference. And he suggested that performance equals potential minus interference. And so the thing that gets in the way of individuals and teams performing at the very highest level is the interference. And that will be different for different people in different organizations. But if I could give your listeners a tip, I would say make a list of all the potential elements of interference, you know, environmentally in the organization, but also inside people's mindset, and then start figuring out how you can remove some of that interference. Because when we start to remove the interference, we release more of the potential of our people inside the business, and the business has a better chance of growing.
That's so, so true.
And it leads me to the third thing. So, sorry, Barad, go ahead.
Go.
The third thing, so if we have the capabilities in the right place, if our culture is in the right place, the third one to look at is the structure. Mm-hmm. You know, have we structured the team to be successful?
Yeah.
Have we structured our systems and processes in a way that they don't get in the way of our team, that they are helpful? And that they also are helpful from a customer context. And if I can just pick the customer side, because I think it's so important, you know, what I increasingly understand based on personal experience as a customer, but also working with teams trying to help customers, is the more effortless you can make their experience, the more likely they are to buy and keep buying. So the way we structure an organization through its systems, its processes, and its people, does it facilitate easy buying? And if there's an issue, does it facilitate easy resolution of those issues?
What do you mean by easy buying? Like, can you unpack that?
Well, the example, and it's possibly horrible to many people because they're so, you know, all-encompassing, is Amazon, right? It's really easy to buy from Amazon, whatever you think about that business. Right. Whatever your mindset is around Amazon as an organization, the simple fact is that they have cracked easy buying, right? And easy resolution of issues.
Right.
And because it's easy, millions and millions of people are buying every single day.
Every single day. Like, whenever I have a choice between Amazon or another, I go with Amazon because customer service.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that, you know, in that organization, we don't actually even talk to a human being. There's, you know, unless you get into Amazon Web Services or some of the other things, that some of the higher ticket items that they are selling, you know, there's no sales team per se, you know. It's
no,
so, you know, Amazon is just one example. If I think about Apple, Apple is easy to buy from. I mean, I may have a slight bias as I talk to you here on my iMac with my Apple Watch on and my iPad and my iPhone, is that, you know, I've taken the Kool-Aid where Apple comes. But iTunes, you know, apps, for a very long time, it's been very easy to buy from Apple.
Right. Easy buying and easy resolution. So important.
Yeah. The phrase that I sort of hang this around, and it's not mine, I've stolen it, is an effortless customer experience.
Yeah.
You know, the moment that customers have to put extra effort into buying something or into resolving an issue they have, that's the moment where customer loyalty starts to decline.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is we don't even have to wow our customers.
Right?
That's a nice to have, you know, if we wow our customers, but it doesn't necessarily generate additional loyalty. But what does generate additional loyalty is reducing the effort that it takes to either buy or resolve something.
Yeah, it's like in dating sense, it's like someone that you had a like amazing short time versus, but they were really like unstable, but someone that versus someone that is very stable, reliable, and you could look at them as a long-term relationship material versus the first one is just, we could only rely, like we only see them for like a short term.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to use a dating analogy because my dating days are long past.
Me too, but like, you know, just came to me because when it comes to like basically, especially customers that they want to form loyalty around the life cycle brand, especially like, you know, I like to buy from Apple too. Sometimes it's twice actually. I remember I bought a MacBook. Wasn't a great experience, but I used it for 3 years because I was able to forgive them because of the entire experience. I told myself, I'm going to use it for 3 years. I'm going to sell it and get a better one, hoping the better one is better.
Yeah. Look, I think that's a really good point, is that we will forgive businesses and people that have deposited credit in the trust bank account.
Yeah.
You know, and so if the odd withdrawal is made, we'll forgive that. Right. But if you haven't deposited anything, you can't expect when withdrawals are made that people are still going to trust you. And, you know, that whole thing, we don't necessarily need to wow people. What I do think we need to do is we need to meet their expectations.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, I see where you're going with this. Please unpack.
Well, again, you know, if you ask any CEO of any organization or any individual in an organization, you know, what do we need to do with our customers? They'll probably say we need to wow them. We need to exceed their expectations. You know, we need to go the extra mile. These are all the, you know, phrases we've heard over the last 20 years. And there is some really good reason why that would be of use. The reality is that only has a small impact on customers and their loyalty to a business. What you really need to do is meet their expectation. You know, and I think Amazon does that, you know, if we refer back, I think Amazon does that, right? Meets your expectation. I expect the thing that I ordered to be there on time, and it is. I don't necessarily need anything extra to have had a good experience.
Yeah, no cupcake on top of it, just deliver my parcel.
So, you know, in a tough market, which is kind of where we started this conversation, I think that's even more important. It's that we actually deliver what we say we would deliver to the customers that are buying from us, and focus less on expensive interventions about going the extra mile, and focus more on making your core system, process, and structure is meeting those customer expectations.
100%.
You know, there's no point making the odd gesture because you're trying to fix a fundamental issue in terms of how you're delivering your services and your product to the customer.
Yeah, we have a client right now, same, like exactly the same case. He got to me, he came to me and said, look, I appreciate you want to go extra mile. I don't want you. Just like meet me here and here and here. Deliver this and this and this and deliver it really good. That's what I need from you.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. And of course, it's in our human nature and organizational structural nature that we want to exceed.
Right.
And if everything else is brilliant, right, there's no problem in exceeding, but make sure everything else is brilliant. Let's call it the brilliant basics. Make sure the basics are brilliant.
Steve, I have a question. So I would love to understand how you see the role of sales function working with product and marketing function to deliver on this expectation. it's a challenging market, right?
Yeah.
And often the current product experience is in distance from what the customer wants. So how do we go about creating that brilliant basics?
Yeah. Look, it's a really good question. And how I think about that is that sometimes in organizations, we've siloed these different functions.
That's right.
You know, not necessarily deliberately, but because it sort of makes structural sense to have a product team, a marketing team, and a sales team, and a finance team, et cetera, et cetera. And then we hope that people work together in some kind of matrixed way. What can happen, though, is that these teams work almost independently of each other. And how many times have we heard sales v marketing? You know, we might call it sales and marketing, but often they're in a little bit of a conflict. You know, salespeople will suggest to marketeers that they don't generate enough leads, they're not doing enough around brand awareness, and that all of the stats that they're showing are of no relevance to a salesperson until they actually get to have a conversation with a customer. Marketing will say, we're generating a lot of opportunity and you never follow it up to salespeople. And then product sort of sits out and is creating things, you know, sometimes without real access to marketing and sales in terms of what they're hearing in the marketplace. So I almost think the way to do it is to force these three departments together. And I'm not talking about merging into a massive department unless that makes sense. But I'm meaning force them to spend time with each other so they understand each other's world and that they're working on product, they're working on projects together. Because I think if you truly combine the strength of these three different functions, you're going to have a much better, you're going to create a much better customer experience. Products are going to be better. Sales process is going to be better. And there's going to be more opportunities. Marketing are going to be better. You know, so that's my view. And in a slightly different setting, you know, I've seen businesses where people from different functions could be customer facing.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is an example. So you might have a commercial salesperson. You might have a clinical specialist and you might have a marketing specialist, right? Each of whom can have conversations with a customer in a healthcare environment. Now, sometimes they're not joined up in terms of who's meeting whom. So if it's a high ticket item and you need to meet multiple stakeholders and working as a team is going to help, you almost need one individual to be the lead conductor of the orchestra. Right. They don't have to do everything. They're not the experts in every instrument, but they do understand what's going on and they're managing the flow. So I think there's real power in bringing that into, you know, the SaaS environment as well, which is who's the lead conductor?
Yeah.
And who's in our orchestra? And you know, which customers and what type of buyer personas are they connecting with?
You talked about high value contracts, especially enterprise sales. I think that's something that's a holy grail of sales. I think there is an art to it. It's a very complex process because you have to deal with a lot of stakeholders. Some of them are known to you, some of them are unknown to you. Especially the unknown ones, they are intentionally want to be unknown so they can make the shots in the background so you don't have so much influence over them. The sales cycle is long. It's the expectations are often extensive and they want customized products or services. So how do you... It's a very general question, but how do startups, especially startups that they want to sell, they want to make sales to enterprises should rethink their sales processes in order to have a shot.
Yeah, look, that's how long have you got? I mean, there are, there are many different components to making it successful. Look, a few things that might be helpful. One is, if you're in a startup position, you want to start, you want to sell at an enterprise level, you have to start a bit smaller somewhere. You've got to build credibility that that your product and service actually creates value for organizations. Okay. Because without those testimonials and case studies, it's really difficult to establish credibility to even get through the door of these larger organizations. So, you know, start somewhere, get some customers. Don't fixate on the size of those customers to start with. Just start building your, I've heard people call it vanity stories, or your, you know, your vanity board. Yeah, this is those badges that you collect of new customers. So start somewhere and get some success. The really important thing that is often missed is in those early sales, actually create case studies. Make it part of your process with the customer that you are so confident that you're going to create value in their business that you want to measure it and you want to create a case study. Because those case studies are going to be your currency later to open some of the doors into larger organizations. Otherwise, what you're left describing is anecdotal features and benefits. So that leads me to the second thing that can help. You need those metrics, right? You need metrics to demonstrate you've added value somewhere else at similar customers with similar problems. And then you also need a way to figure out how to quantify the benefit of your product or service.
Hmm.
So you can sit with a customer and say, I really want to make sure that you make money by buying our products and services. So let's figure out whether the return on investment makes sense.
Hmm.
So now I go from being a sales rep to being a consultant inside their business to help them make a better decision. Because if we can demonstrate a good positive ROI, it makes the buying decision easier for them.
That's almost like business consultancy, the way you are approaching it right now.
Yeah. Mm. And if you want someone to spend $100,000, $1 million, $10 million, euros, pounds, you need to be a business consultant, not a salesperson.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what I picked up from the way you frame it, you don't come across hasty or, hey, let me just make a sale to you. You sort of like implying, hey, I'm willing to walk the talk with you.
Mm.
Interesting.
When I'm doing some training with salespeople, I sometimes talk to them about the marshmallow test, right? The marshmallow test, for those of you that may not know, was a test conducted on 5-year-old children back in the 1970s where they were given one marshmallow but told, if you don't eat that marshmallow for a period of time, I'll give you another marshmallow, so you'll have two instead of one. And then they observe what happens with those children. You know, some of them, they just eat it immediately. They can't resist. Others, they might sniff it or lick it, but they can resist. And then these psychologists who conducted the test follow these children as they're growing up, and they found on every level of success, whether it was academic, career, or relationship success, the children that resisted the longest were the most successful. Why? Because they could delay that instant gratification.
Mm.
It's a good strategy for life. Now, the reason why I share that story with salespeople is that I think sometimes we can be like those 5-year-old children. We get a sniff of an opportunity and we try and gobble it up all at once. When actually, if we demonstrated a bit more patience, you know, if we'd asked a few more questions to understand the customer in a bit more detail, if we'd met some other stakeholders within that customer organization, what we might find is there's a whole bag of marshmallows, a whole bunch of different ways that we can help the customer. But that one marshmallow can be irresistible. Now, I do have one caveat to this. If there's only one marshmallow to be eaten, eat it before someone else eats it. Right? But don't delay so long that someone comes and steals your marshmallow.
Yeah, it's an art, because I get, you know, one of my challenges when I'm approaching sales is to understand whether a customer has budget, right? Because all these discovery calls. So, for example, for one of the biggest banking providers in Europe, I conducted several workshops. They did not pay me at all for it because I knew that they are a big bank. But for a 20 people startup that they have a offshore team and they have only two teams in London, finding whether they can afford is always, it's not easy. Right. So I think a lot of business owners are not sure whether this case, this lead is worthy of investment of their time.
Yeah, it's a really good point, you know, and I think sometimes we're fearful of asking people if they've got any money. You know, it can feel uncomfortable or awkward to be so direct and say, have you got any money? So if there is a need, if the customer has defined a need and they are actively looking for alternative solutions to fulfill that need, then there's a chance that they've either allocated a budget already or they're going to go and win the budget, right? Once they understand how much it might cost to be able to fulfill that need. So that's one scenario. They have a need, they've defined it. There'll either be a budget allocated or they've got to put a business case together still to win the budget. If there was no defined need, but they've suddenly decided they have a need because you as the supplier have managed to provoke a need, right? You've still got the same options. There could be some money that's been allocated somewhere, or they've got to go and win. So either way, at the appropriate time, if it feels like they believe there's value in my solution, I have to ask the question. And I'm going to ask it, and I'm going to ask it as simply as that. Look, is this something you've already allocated budget to, or will you have to go and win the budget?
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So it's a slightly politer way of saying, have you got any money? Yeah. Now, if the budget is allocated, great. Okay. Well, maybe then we can talk about the range of budget that's required to actually buy the solution, to implement it. You know, so I'm going to be very open with the customer. I'm going to say, look, to solve the problems you've got or achieve the things that you want to achieve, typically it's going to cost somewhere between A and J. You know, does that fit within the budget you've allocated?
Right.
Yeah. Or do you need to go and win some more? Now, if the budget is allocated or they've got to go and win some more, in either case, I'm going to say, look, let's make sure we've got a robust business case because someone somewhere will ask you to justify why you're spending this budget or why you're looking to get some budget to do this.
So you're working with them to justify. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. Because otherwise they're going to anecdotally sell my solution inside their organization. So look, we really need it. It's great. And it fixes X, Y, Z, and it allows us to do ABC. But as you go up the food chain inside an organization to FD, CEO, etc., the economic buyer is going to ask, okay, so what's the ROI?
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I'd love to get access to those people if at all possible, and I will ask to get access to those people. But if I can't, I need to make sure that the person I'm working with or the team I'm working with have the business case. And it's as strong as it can possibly be.
So you're basically trying to become friend with the person you are interacting with or become comrade. I'm trying to understand your perspective or like way of working. You know that the person that you're talking to is not the CFO. Probably your chances of talking to CFO is that much, almost zero. So let me become comrade with this person, understand his concept, because he has to go, he has to respond to the CFO. CFO is asking for software for a quarter now. The quarter is about to end. He has to come up with the response, right? And then you're saying that, okay, Sally, this, if we want to solve this problem of your organization, the budget range is about this to this. Is this something that is already budgeted, or do you have to go ask for more? Okay. That's fantastic.
So think about the relationship, you know, and it has to come from a place of positive intent. You know, we have to come from a place where we truly believe that what we're doing is designed to help our customer to be more successful.
Right.
My intent is to make them succeed. And if my solution is the thing that's going to help them to be more successful, it's not about selling them something. It's about how they grow their own business by solving problems that my solution solves, or by giving them some benefits that give them a competitive advantage. So with that true intent, you know, I changed the dynamic from sales buyer. We almost become coaches together. And what I mean by that is, in an organization, we're going to look for an internal coach, right? The person that really is an advocate of you and your solution, that likes you and believes you're credible, and they coach you about their business. Yeah, they tell you the kind of people that you need to be involved with. They tell you information that they wouldn't necessarily tell other people that's going to be helpful for you to be able to create a solution that meets their needs and pull together a compelling pitch and proposal. So that's the coach on their side, but I'm also a coach of them. Because interestingly, sometimes these coaches don't know how to get buying decisions made inside their own organization. But I do, because I've worked with hundreds of companies.
Right.
So I'm going to coach them about the need for a business case and how we pull that together. I'm going to coach them about the need to get a coalition of stakeholders together, so that each person that might be involved in this decision-making process has an opportunity to either meet with me if I'm the person selling the solution, or at least meet with each other. Because if you can't get those people to meet with each other, guess what happens to the decision? Yeah. And I've just found, to my cost, and there is research to support this, if you've got one decision maker in the process, you've got an 80% plus chance that a decision will be made.
Okay.
Now,
makes sense.
Of course, you would like that to be favorable. You'd like it to be a yes, because that's what we're there to try and get. But I'll take a no. Yeah. If there's a good reason for the customer to say no, if they've got a better option, or they've decided not to do it because it wasn't compelling enough, you know, that's their choice. That's freedom of choice. What really kills me, and I know kills many businesses, is the long drawn out maybe. You know, where things just don't seem to happen, and we're using energy trying to re-energize the sales process. As soon as you go from one decision maker to two decision makers in a process, the chance of getting a decision goes down to 50%.
Wow.
In a typical complex B2B buying decision, there are over five people involved. And by the time you get to five people involved in decision making, your chance of success actually doesn't drop massively, but it's at about 40% now, right, of any kind of decision being made. So often when you got these multiple stakeholders, they stick with the status quo because it feels like the least risky option.
That's right.
Yep. Because making a new buying decision comes with risk. You know, they've got to invest time, energy, money. So unless it's really compelling, and unless you've managed to coach the internal coach, the likelihood is you're gonna lose momentum in the opportunity, and it's gonna stay in your pipeline forever until you get ruthless and take it out.
And you think that you're being ghosted because they chose another provider, but the reality is they haven't made a decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible.
I learned about this like a bit before, like in another conference, that a lot of big B2B purchases, like actually they don't happen for a long time.
Yeah, it's true. So look, it could be you're ghosted because they've solved it with somebody else. That's possible. Yes. It could be you're ghosted because it's kind of lost momentum and they've got 1,000 other priorities that have got in the way. It could be that, you know, the people moved. You know, there's a ton of reasons why you suddenly get ghosted. None of which are very helpful. I mean, the big one is that people are just too polite to say, I'm really sorry, we don't think this is the right solution for us. And that politeness actually turns into impoliteness.
Yeah.
And I think people sometimes are worried they're going to get into a conflict where you're going to try and persuade them that they're wrong in some way. Well, that rarely works and is rarely the case. And I also think ghosting people is easier than ever because we're interacting through these screens or through emails. Like, you know, in the old days, we used to sit down in a room with people and there was maybe a little bit more trust in the relationship got built that way. Right? So it was harder to ghost people. You know, it felt even more impolite. I will give your listeners one great tip, and it can feel awkward to do, but it keeps momentum in the process. And it's an acronym that is HAMBAM. And HAMBAM stands for Have a Meeting, Book a Meeting. So when you're in the sales process and you have interest and the stakeholder on the customer side is seeing value in continuing the process, either getting you to meet some other people or have another meeting with them to understand them in a bit more detail or to do a proposal or pitch to them, before you leave that meeting, book the next meeting.
Ah, that's really cool.
Otherwise, because of people's schedules, you just lose days and weeks and sometimes months, you know, and so now you've lost momentum in that opportunity. And sometimes it's just the loss of momentum that kills the deal.
That's right. Wow.
Now, if the stakeholder on the other side rejects your desire to book the next meeting, then there's probably a message in that as well.
That's right. Not a good signal, I would say.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a positive signal. Yeah. Oh, can you just send me a proposal, Steve? I've heard that, right? It's like, I'd love to. But better than that, I'd like to book a meeting for a week's time because it's going to take me a few days to pull that proposal together and I'll take you through it because undoubtedly you'll have a load of questions. You know, and I'll be able to bring it to you.
Wow, that's really, I need to record this. I need to use it for my pickup line. That's really good. So it's like, hey, I'm not going to send you. You're probably going to have a lot of questions. We're going to go back and forth between emails. Why don't we just like book a call, right? I send you 2 days before. You read it and we jump in and we can have a conversation.
Perfect. Because that's ultimately what you want to happen anyway, is that you're able to have a conversation around the proposal. Because there might be things you need to change. There might be questions that they've got. And the quickest, most effective way of doing it is just book that meeting there and then. And you also sense check their commitment. Have they asked you to do the proposal as a polite no? Right. Berad, I'm not really interested in this, but I'm going to make you do a load of work and write up a proposal and send it to me. Is that okay?
Oh, well, thanks for being polite. I'm candid.
Yeah. So that's not what they say. What they say, yeah, send me a proposal. It'd be great. Love to see it. Yeah, and you do that. You go away and do the work. Yeah, never hear from them again.
So, Steve, I've got millions of questions. I want to be respectful of time, but I would like to get in 10 minutes two questions in.
Sure.
So, when I listened to you, I felt like this gentleman has years of experience accumulated, massive, massive, massive bunch of wisdom. So when he goes to a call, he can navigate all this under the skin, gestures, and, you know, hints that you need to pick up to be able to move the sales forward for young entrepreneurs and founders and sales folks that they don't have these experiences. I felt a bit helpless when I was listening to you, because there is a lot of things I don't pick up in this conversation, in these calls. How should we navigate these calls when we don't have your experience?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And there is access to a huge amount of information out there, as you know. We could Google almost anything. Other search engines are available. So I do think you need to become a little bit of a geek in sales. You know, for every entrepreneur, if you can't sell or you can't build a sales team, your business is going to struggle.
You sign it off, yes.
Yeah.
And yet there are so many different things we could be spending our time on that sometimes selling is almost a byproduct of our learning, right? We sell through it. We learn through experience. That seemed to work, so I'll carry on doing that particular thing. That didn't really work very well, so maybe that doesn't work for me. What I'm going to suggest to your listeners is number one, read some books, right? Or listen to some books if that's your preference. And if I could give a recommendation, there's a book called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play by a guy called Mahan Khalsa. And it's a little dated now because I think he originally wrote it in 1999. But for me, that is one of the very best sales books out there. And the reason why I think it's so brilliant is because it really is about the subtext is helping clients succeed. So it really is about making sure that you've got that intent that, you know, your success is built on the back of your customer's success. And so anything you do that can make them more successful is going to lead to your, to, you know, the growth of your own business. So release the pressure of selling from your own shoulders and start learning about how you get on the client side. I would pick a questioning technique because for me, sales is all about our ability to ask great questions and then shut up and listen to the answers.
100%.
So find a questioning technique that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own model that works very nicely called GRID. Very simple. It's about four different parts of a conversation with a customer, four things that you might want to know. The G is for the goal. I'd love to know what the customer's goals are, you know, strategic goals of their business or project goals or personal goals. You know, or what they want to achieve, you know, those kind of questions that lead to understanding a customer's goals. In a review, I really want to understand their situation. What's going on for that customer in their business that it might be useful for me to know so I can position a solution that's going to help them. And I'm going to ask within that review piece, I'm going to ask questions that uncover problems. What problems has the customer got that I might be able to solve? The eye of GRID is impact then, which is probing a bit more around problems or probing a bit more around benefits that they want to really see, could we quantify the cost of the problem?
Mm.
And you can use questions to quantify the cost of a problem. You know, a simple one would be customer shares a problem with you and you could say, what's the impact of that on your business? Or how much is that costing you? You know, so these questions find out the impact. And then the D part of GRID is the decision. You know, what's their process for making a decision? What's their criteria? So what's important to them in making a decision like this? Budget, timescales, people. You know, so GRID is a really useful structure, simple and effective. But there are others out there. You know, some people may have come across spin selling from Huthway. You know, it's been around for decades, really useful. You know, powerful questions in there. And you can buy a book on that and find out how to do spin selling.
Right.
So I would say, you know, keep educating yourselves around sales because we can stand on the shoulder of giants, you know, because people, there's so much information. But really focus to start with on your questioning and listening skills.
That's fantastic. I really love the way you frame it. Find your own questions. Find the question you are comfortable with, because I've heard other sales gurus that say, here are the questions you have to ask, da, da, da. But I read them, it's like, I don't, it's not me. I don't feel it. But yeah, I like that so much better. Go read, pick up your question that you're comfortable with, and just make it part of your daily conversation.
Yeah. And the great thing about questioning skills and listening skills is we can practice them.
Hmm.
And the best people to practice them with are your customers. Because they don't know you're practicing.
Steve, fantastic. Hey, I really need to get this question in. And I think it's a question that a lot of other folks will have. I run an agency. I run a business. I sell to B2Bs. So my question is around pricing, my packages. We have a retainer fee, right? That we know that if we sell it below 15,000, it's not good for our business. Well, in terms of we can sell it lower for sure, 12K, 13, 11, but it's, you know, we won't have margin. Business without the margin is nothing. Sometimes I go in the calls, and instead of saying it's 15K, right away I say 12.
Hmm.
I think that's the problem I've seen other folks do. We want to get the business. We are already willing to give a discount. Without the client is not asking, we are giving a discount like by default. What's wrong with my mindset? What should I do differently?
Look, and what you're describing in negotiation terms, we call a blind concession. We're already discounting before we even tell the customer the price, right? We didn't say necessarily, oh, it's 15,000 normally, but for you, because you're so nice, I'm doing it for 12,000, right? Sometimes we just go in at 12 because we think, oh, maybe this isn't, they won't pay 15,000. It's not necessarily a mindset issue. It's a sales process issue.
Hmm.
So in very simple terms, value or return on investment is made up of benefit minus cost.
Mm.
So 15,000 is the cost in this example. Mm-hmm. If you can't quantify the benefit with a customer, then the return part of the ROI disappears and all you're left with is the I. And that investment turns into a C, which is cost, and it'll always feel a bit too high. So the key for me is to understand the value from a quantifiable benefits perspective that your solution brings for your customers. Right. And as long as that value is credible, and in the context of that quantifiable benefit, that is more than the cost, then you'll never need to discount again.
Okay. This has been...
The only reason you might choose to discount is because they're going to give you something else as a trade.
I see.
You know, if I can leave your listeners with one final thought then around that is, you know, never give something to a customer without getting something in return. And the something in return has to be more than the initial contract.
Right.
So if I'm going to give you a price reduction, maybe I want a volume increase. You know, I can give you more at a slightly less price, right? That's possible.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to give you the slightly less price, I want the more.
Yeah. So never give anything without taking something or seeing something coming to you in return.
Yeah, see it as a trade. Otherwise, it's unfair.
I think you hit it on the nail. A lot of business, like especially up-and-coming business owners, they don't understand they are running a business. Business is essentially about trade. It's not if you want to make friends, go make friends. I don't know, go out, make friends, do something. This is business. You have to trade.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we're in the playground and we used to swap things, you know, maybe we had some Panini soccer cards and stickers, right? And I had a particular footballer that you wanted. I'm not just going to give you that, right? That's unfair. Right? I'm going to look in your pack of stickers and I'm going to say, which of those do I want? Right? We trade. we learn to trade in the playground, and yet we run a business, and then all of a sudden we feel under pressure to give something without getting something in return. Or we feel that the getting something in return is the original contract. Well, that's not a fair trade. The fair trade was selling that contract at 15,000, not 12. So if you are going to give them a 3,000 reduction, what do you want in return for that?
That's right. Steve, this has been, I'm really happy that we made this happen. I'm going to actually reach out to you, see how we can use your services for our business. But a lot of folks are listening to this. Maybe talk quickly about SalesStrong, what you guys offer, how founders listening to this could benefit from your services.
I don't know if you'll post where we are, but if you look up www.salesstrong.co.uk, you'll find us there. You'll see the kind of services that we offer. But to really position it, you know, our strap line is sales growth guaranteed. So if you want to grow your business and you want to do that by improving the capability of your team that are selling, by looking at how you've structured the team around that and the culture that you've got in place, we have many different ways of approaching, you know, those challenges, and it's bespoke and tailored to each and every client that comes to us. So if that's of interest, then, you know, drop us a line.
You heard the man, folks. I hope that you could reach out to him, because I'm going to reach out. Steve, appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you, Bharat. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more information, go to bonanza-studios.com.